in our Pride and Prejudice series, and we're going to be reflecting on our friendships. When you think of your close friends, who do you think of? Who comes to mind? What would you say defines your friendship? Just take a moment and think about that for a second. There were two guys out in a canoe in the middle of a lake. They had they'd gone on some intense paddling, some adventure. Here's the setup: this beautiful sunshine, still waters, snow-tipped mountains at every turn, and it was just this breathtaking scene. And somehow these two guys got into this game. I was at the front of the boat. My good friend Ben, short for Benjamin, was at the back of the boat, and we just were taking turns throwing out our paddle, and then the other guy would go and paddle, and we'd go towards it. So I leaned back at the front and just gave it a good chuck, and got a good distance, and I was like, all right, that was a good one. Then I heard a second sound. And I remember it distinctly. I turned very slowly, looked at my friend Ben, and his jaw was like this. And he was frozen, and I looked down at his hands. There was nothing in his hands. We had both thrown the paddles at the exact same time. He could see me. I couldn't see him. And we just... After some, like, what you, we just started howling in laughter and then proceeded to paddle with our arms in freezing cold water and eventually got our paddles. And sometime later, the color and circulation entered our arms again. And this really isn't surprising for the two of us. This was a friendship forged over a 16-hour drive in a 67 Camaro with racing orange stripes to go for some burgers over the weekend. Do you know a little place called in Redding, California? Anybody know what's there? Yes, I'm thinking of the burger joint. I heard it. Who said it? In-N-Out Burgers. That's right. So I don't know if you guys had In-N-Out Burgers? So for college students, this was this magical place to go to. So we decided, very impromptu, he had the car, I went along with him, and that was what forged the friendship. And I remember as a cheap college student trying to get a hold of In-N-Out to convince them that they should give us our food for free because we were coming from a foreign country. And they were great. They graciously just said, no, we're not able to do that. And then so we get there, very few stops. There's three of us, Ben, Randall, and me. And we get there and we just kind of like, the loosening up the arms, and we get out and we go up. And I can't resist, as we order our, triple patty burgers, animal style, with chocolate shakes and fries, and I have to tell them the story of how long it's taken us, saying, we drove from Canada to come here to you for these burgers. And I remember it distinctly as well. The girl looks up. She looks at me. And she says, hold on a second. And then she goes to the back, and we're waiting there, going, what's going on? And the manager comes out, and he says, we've been waiting for you guys. Get whatever you want. The food's on us. Free T-shirts. I thought about wearing the T-shirt. I don't know. I went a little. Maybe I should have wore the T-shirt. I still have it. It's a little worn. So they gave free T-shirts, and they said, can we take pictures with you? we want to put you on our presentation board. And we're like, yeah, that's okay, sure. My friend Ben and I have got into many adventures. I texted him this morning on WhatsApp. He lives in Berlin these days. And I just said, hey, I'm going to tell a few of our stories this morning. Really appreciate you thinking about you. And when it comes to these adventures, there's something that underwrites our friendship even more. And I think of Ben's humility. If we've been talking about Pride and Prejudice, pride as a self-absorption with your own self, and humility being the opposite of pride, thinking less about ourselves and more about others, I think of my friend Ben and his humility and how that has impacted our friendship. Another moment with Ben I could still remember, post-college roommates facing the world together after graduating college. Well, I got ahead of him a year, but that's just because I'm smarter than him. But no, when you are buddies, you have to hassle each other. It just comes with the territory, and I would expect it back. But he said, that's why we're talking about him as the humble one again. No, he said, Dave, how can I help you today? And I remember just being like, what? Like, this is, my college buddy just said, hey, Dave, how can I help you today? I don't even think I gave her a response. I was so flabbergasted because I don't think I'd ever had anybody ask me that question in my life. Just over the course of our friendship, I think of the many times where he's asked me some good heart questions. Hey, Dave, are you living into the person that you say you are? Are you acting out what you believe as an accountability partner, as a trusted friend? I think of a season where I was really struggling with burdens that I was carrying and an anxiousness that had really developed deep in my heart. And I remember just in that whole journey of sorting it through, I remember the breakthrough was praying with my friend Ben. And it was a breakthrough, and I didn't have to carry that anymore. God used this friendship to grow me, and a foundation of this was humility. It is a friendship of a lifetime for me. This morning, we are going to talk about, even more than a friendship of a lifetime, a friendship of the ages that we read about in the scriptures. It's a friendship of not only a David, but the David, with his friend from the tribe of Benjamin, Jonathan, heir to the throne of Israel. So I want to invite you into looking at the scriptures this morning that God would be speaking into our lives, specifically in this area of friendship and what we can learn about from Jonathan, a case study on humility in friendship. So if you have a Bible with you, I invite you to open it to 1 Samuel 18. We're going to key in on verses 3 and 4 this morning, but I will read to you just this section of 1 to 5. A reading from the ESV. As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David and his armor and even his sword and his bow and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war, and this was good in the sight of all the people and also in the sight of Saul's servants. So, as we said earlier, this major thing we're looking at this morning is that it was Jonathan's humility that created a friendship for the ages. We're going to focus on how it was Jonathan's humility that created a friendship for the ages. And if somebody who likes to know kind of where things are going, really we're going to be talking about how Jonathan's humility enabled him to love David well, and how his humility enabled him to let go of his rights, and how Jonathan's humility enabled him to live within God's will. So let's look at that first thought, that it was Jonathan's humility that enabled him to love David well. You see it. Verse 3, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul. To love someone as you love yourself. You know, Jesus said, this is the second greatest commandment out of everything, to love your neighbor as yourself. How do you define love? So often we talk about love in so many different ways. The scriptures, I think, need to be our guide. Thinking of 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. 1 Corinthians 13. If you don't have love, you can have all these other things, but if you don't have love, then you're not anything. Love is patient. Love is kind. This whole list of not holding on to things, of bearing all things. Love never gives up. I like I've really attached to Tim Kimmel's definition of love. He's written so many great books on parenting, and it comes out of these scriptures. Love is the commitment to another's needs and best interests, no matter the cost to myself. Love is my commitment to another's best interests and needs, no matter the cost to myself. So Jonathan makes this pact. It's a pact of being connected to David. And this word covenant is something quite foreign in our culture, but we talk about it a lot. Because what's that whole first half, second half of the Bible set up as? The Old Covenant, or Testament is another word for it, and the New Covenant, or Testament. This covenant that they make, often in the ancient world, in sacrifices, they would split a bird or an animal in half and say, if I break this, may this be done to me as well. It was intense. It was serious. It was a commitment to the other. So they make a commitment of great loyalty to each other, a solemn pact. How does this pact play out? Just here's where I want to briefly review Jonathan and David and their history. So I read you this verse where it's an introduction to their friendship, this friendship of the ages. It's in the next chapter, we see that Jonathan's dad, King Saul, wants to assassinate his good friend David to make sure that he looks out for his son, Jonathan, to make sure that he gets the throne, because he feels that David is a threat, that David's going to get the throne, and the only way to ensure that Jonathan gets it is that they kill David. But here we see Jonathan's humility. If we're thinking about thinking less about ourselves and more about others, in chapter 19, he talks back to his dad, and he acts as protector, and he acts as intercessor for David. His love isn't self-focused, but focused on the friendship of David. Quote on friendship. They aren't your friends until they've defended you in your absence. They aren't your friends until they've defended you in your absence. Isn't that a good test of friendship? When someone's speaking badly of you and your friend sticks up for you, what does that mean to you? Well, that happens here with Jonathan, sticks up for his friend David. Jonathan, depending on the version of your translation here, in the NLT, we have Jonathan echoing the words of my friend Ben of, "How can I help you?" Chapter 20, verse 4, reading in the ESV, he just says, "Whatever you say, I will do. Whatever you say, I will do." This is what Jonathan says as an expression of his pact. And in this chapter, there's several references to how they return again and again to their covenant to each other. "I'm committed to you." When's the last time you've returned to that great friendship and affirmed in word, "I'm committed to you"? Hey, maybe today's an opportunity for you to reach out to that really good friend and just say, "Hey, I was thinking of you. Just want to let you know the significant role you play in my life, and I am committed to you." So there's this whole process of Saul's anger and hatred, and he really reflects the opposite of Jonathan. He reflects pride, a self-absorption, and what that does in destroying his relationship with David. So he's the contrast. He plays the fool in character to his own son. So he's at the family dinner table. David's been missing, and he's like, "Where's David?" You know, this devious laugh. And Jonathan's just kind of, you know, trying to protect him, but it just keeps escalating because he's been gone at the throne table for several days. And it escalates to this point, chapter 20, verse 30. Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan, and he said to him, "Well, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame, to the shame of your mother's nakedness?" Can you imagine your own dad saying something in a way where he's cursing at you for your actions? Maybe some of you have gone through this. Maybe some of you experienced a destructive relationship with your dad, like Jonathan had. "For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, neither you nor your kingdom shall be established. Therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." Then Jonathan answered Saul, his father, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Like, "Dad, don't say that about my friends." And then unlike, I'm hoping, all of our fathers, Jonathan's father at the family dinner table happens to have a spear. And he's extremely temperamental. Not only is he aggressive, not only does he swear at you, but when he's upset, he will grab the spear and throw it at you. Thankfully, Jonathan is used to this sort of behavior from dad. You don't sit on your hands at family dinner time. You're ready. So, I'm also thinking the king's table is probably a little bit larger than most of our tables. He ends up ducking the spear, and it says he went off to his room without any supper because he didn't feel like eating anymore. You know, you just, put this in context to all our family meals here. But what does this mean? In humility, Jonathan is willing to not only take the wrath of his father, but he's willing to risk his very life for his friend. This is sacrifice. Jonathan, over and over again in the story, we see his humility and how he loves David more than himself. He considers David more than himself. It was Jonathan's humility that created a friendship for the ages. So when someone looks to assassinate the character of your friend, what do? Are you willing to stand in the gap for them when they're not there to stick up for themselves? Are you willing to put in the effort and the trouble to go and protect them? Are you willing to put your own reputation, losing face, losing position, losing favor before others, for your friends? When's the last time you have reaffirmed your friendship pact? Have you taken the courage to vulnerably express your love for a great friend? As we talk about Pride and Prejudice, I can't not think of how I'm going through Jackie Robinson's biography. I'm reading two books on his life, one written by Rachel Robinson, his wife, and one written by a commentator, Ed Henry. And Ed Henry's book says, hey, I know there's been a lot written about famous baseball player Jackie Robinson, but I'm really going to explore what a lot of most mainstream books don't look at is the faith of Jackie Robinson and how his Christian faith enabled him to do in strength what others had never done in breaking through the racism and prejudice in Major League Baseball, but not just Major League Baseball, but society. This was a huge epic breakthrough in society. And Jackie Robinson, in breaking through the color barrier in baseball, ended up giving leverage to the whole movement of dealing with the ugliness of racism in society. And he rubbed shoulders with people like Martin Luther King Jr. Well, reflect this book, 42, Faith, written by Ed Henry, is reflects on how the GM of the Dodgers, the famous Branch Rickey, ended up coming to this church just down the street from Brooklyn Dodger Stadium, and he was pacing back and forth, and he just went to church to really sort out in his head that he was going to commit to doing this. And then he committed to doing this with Jackie Robinson, and he committed to Jackie Robinson as the man to break through because of his strength, because of his courage, but also because of his faith upbringing. And interestingly, it explores how Jackie Robinson would never have been the man that he was. He came from a broken home, a mom of great faith, but he was in the wrong crowds, being influenced by the wrong kind of friends. And a man of faith from their church took him in and invested in him and saw who he could become. I'm sure he didn't fully see who he could become, but he took him in and he mentored him. He discipled him. And Jackie became a different person. His life was transformed from the friends that he had. And his life was transformed through his faith, and that allowed him to not have to fight back in those years where people on his own team, they made alliances, they tried to get signings that they wouldn't play with him, opposing teams and managers would berate him, fans would yell and scream at him, and this was an intensely strong man who his natural instincts was to fight back, but in his faith, he turned the other cheek and enabled the breakthrough for more and more people to break through the color barrier, that it wasn't a thing. It eventually became the thing that it was. He laid down his rights in order to benefit his fellow human beings. If it was not just Jonathan's humility that enabled him to love David well, it was also that his humility enabled him to lay down his rights. Jonathan's humility enabled him to lay down his rights. It's the book of Samuel is an incredible book. You know, if you're counting both 1 and 2 Samuel, there's so much said in so few words. And the actions, you're really, especially in Hebrew writing, you've really got to look at the actions. And you got to look closely to see what they mean. So there's so much said in these small actions, in these short verses. Verse 4, chapter 18 of 1 Samuel. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, and he gave it to David, and his armor, even his sword, and his bow and his belt. What does this mean? We look at a few other situations where robes were given. If you look at Genesis 41, you see how Pharaoh brings out a royal robe for Joseph. And he becomes second in command. And it's a display of bearing the Pharaoh's power. You can read about that in Genesis 41. In Esther 6, you see King Xerxes asks Haman, hey, what would be the right way to honor someone? And Haman thinks it's about himself. And the first place he goes is, he should wear one of the royal robes. He should wear a robe that the king himself has worn. And he's picturing himself wearing it. This is the way to honor. Well, even further than that is this story right here. 1 Samuel 18. Jonathan, heir to the throne, takes off the royal robe. He doesn't just bring a second one. He takes off his own robe and he gives it to David. And it's a laying down of his heir to the throne. It is a profound act of friendship. It is a profound act where he recognizes that though the world has anointed him to take the throne, God has anointed David to be the heir to the throne. It doesn't really say that. You're reading between the lines through this action and the action preceding it in 1 Samuel 16, where Samuel the prophet anoints David to be the next king. Verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward, and Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. So there's this connection. This is this third piece here that I want to draw out, that it's a Jonathan's humility not only enabled him to love David well, it enabled him to lay down his rights, but it also enabled him to get in line with God's will. If you think about it, the world is saying, this is your right. This is your position. And if you prioritize the voice of the world, the voice of his father, the voice of the king over the Lord, then he would have followed that and he would have said, David, take a seat, son. I'm better than you. David, all throughout this book of Samuel, so incredibly, is known as the one who is loved. He's loved by Jonathan. He's loved by Michal, Saul's daughter. He's loved by the people. And his very name means beloved. He is loved in profound ways, and he's known for the one after God's own heart. Well, Jonathan himself is known for his great faith. This is not a weak man saying, no, you just do it. This man has a huge sense of his own identity. And I think like our own, we build a really strong identity in knowing who we are when we first know who God is. You can read about it in 1 Samuel 14. This guy takes on a lot of guys, like single-handedly with his armor bearer, and it's all out of his expression of knowing who God is. And him and David are set apart. They're set apart as knowing who God is when the whole nation doesn't. And it's really profound. There's these connections. 1 Samuel 14, Jonathan knows who God is. And it leads to a significant victory. And he is beloved by the people as well, because his dad, the king, makes a foolish vow. It's going to lead to his son's death. But the people say, I don't care what you said. We're defending Jonathan. He's beloved. He knows who God is. He knows who he is. And out of that identity, it enables him to know and love others. He doesn't have to concentrate on himself because he knows who God is. and he knows who he is. So he doesn't have to worry about, you know, thrusting himself forward. He can love David. In the same way, David, 1 Samuel 16, he knows who God is too. He knows that the battle against their enemies, the Philistines, isn't just a battle of him versus a giant. It's God against this whole army. So he goes as the underdog in the world's eyes, but he was never the underdog because he knows that the Lord fights our battles. Do you know that the Lord fights your battles? Do you know what the Lord does in forging our friendships and our relationships, in knowing who he is and how that is a leverage for a strong identity? There's this piece of, you still love yourself. There's not a total, it's not as if you hate yourself. This love your neighbor as yourself. There's this premise that you embrace that you can love yourself in who God has made you to be. Because God doesn't make mistakes. He loves who you are. So this thing, Jonathan gets in line with God's will by recognizing that David is heir to the throne. He's not a weak character, but he's incredibly strong, and his strength gets displayed in humility. And Jonathan's humility doesn't just point us to the kind of friends that we should become. His humility points us to the ultimate model of humility in pointing us to Christ. As we reflected last week, Philippians chapter 2, this passage which we talked about as the defining passage on humility, doing nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than ourselves, letting each of you look not to our own interests, but also to the interests of others, having the very mind of Christ, who though he was in the form of God, the divinity, the robe of God, he took on our robes, not counting equality with God as a thing that we could be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking the form of a servant, being born in likeness of men and women, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. He fulfilled his destiny as a man by becoming obedient to the point of death on a cross, and thus becoming our substitute for our sin. This is the new covenant, and it's through his blood. In my friend Ben's friendship with me, numerous different points, his humility has leveraged me into becoming more and more the person God calls me to be. He's spoken on God's behalf. He's spoken what God's intent is for my life. And it's a call for us to not dwell on ourselves, on our own rights, on our own freedoms, in a culture where we tend to dwell on our own rights and freedoms, but to dwell on how we can leverage our friends to become more and more the people that God has called them to be. We talked about in the glory vacuum back in Galatians, we talked about how comparing ourselves to others is a really destructive thing. We either put ourselves down too low or we elevate ourselves too high, but the person we're really to compare ourselves to is the person who God calls us to be. So humility would be thinking less about our own destiny and thinking more about how we can leverage our great friends to become the people who they're called to be. And ultimately, it's Jesus Christ who leverages us most to become the people we're called to be. We're going to reflect in communion about the covenant and what he's all done for us. Right before we get there, I just want us to take a moment and think, what are we going to do with this? What are we going to do with this case study, this model of humility at work in a friendship? Are you going to take some time today, tomorrow, this week, where you just kind of reflect on the focus, your focus in your friendships, and how can you leverage those friendships around you? We are in a church. It's an amazing example of how we together are looking to leverage what God has done in us together, that will impact and bless others. It's a beautiful picture. As we prepare our hearts for communion, let's respond in prayer. Jesus, you have loved us so fully. You have laid down your rights to get in line with God's incredible, eternal, mysterious plan to draw a broken humanity back to yourself. Your humility leverages us for a life of eternity and relationship with you. I just want to pray for anyone who does not feel they have a relationship with you, Jesus. We recognize that it's you who leverages the relationship. Unlike Jonathan and David's equality, you are God and we are not. And it's you who's the whole initiator of the friendship, and it's us who's the responder. It's us who responds to your lordship, your salvation. It's us who bends a knee and recognizes you as Lord and Savior. I pray for anyone who does not feel that they have that relationship here this morning, that you would leverage them here in hearing your word to just take a moment and recognize the friendship that you offer. If this is your heart's desire to have a friendship with Jesus, thinking about him and all that he is, I pray that you will humbly take a moment and say, yes, Lord, I want what you have to offer. I humbly recognize that I have not been the friend back that you've made me design me to be, nor the friend to others that you've made me design me to be. If that's your prayer to accept Jesus as Lord and Savior, he responds and he accepts you as friend, and God calls you a son or daughter, and you get to be heir to the eternal throne. So God, we pray these things. And for those who know you, prepare our hearts to again recognize this covenant made through your body and blood, symbolized in communion. These things we pray. Amen. So if you've never